Thank you. That's
a canine
helpful.
To go.
Yeah. When we think of misdemeanors, I tend to think of something else and littering and such.
Shoplifting and
yeah, there's some assaults. A lot of assaults would be considered a misdemeanor, assault force.
Potentially, we could craft a policy, though, that says for littering, for the really minor misdemeanors that we would
I think we would be totally willing to look at that. For the lower-level violations, we wouldn't want to send a dog.
And that, so you would agree that
I would agree in that particular incident, it would be something we should look at, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions for the chief?
Yeah, I guess.
Commanders.
So the question about, or the suggestion about eliminating the commander's memo in part of, in the police reviews to make things more expeditious.
Let Dave go ahead and address that.
Dave Famous, Captain, Professional Standards Division. In most cases, the commander's memorandum kind of brings the incident and the story, if you will, together in one document. It explains what happened, what the witnesses said, what the complainant said, what the officer said, and provides a recommendation. In officer-involved shooting investigations, internal affairs, we actually provide a template that provides the areas of review, and included in that is tactical recommendations, operational planning, post-shooting. And that document that is presented by a commander is an important document for the Bureau to consider because it brings all the whole situation into one document.
If I could add to that, having actually written a review, the commander's finding, I can tell you that it, for the commander's position, is extremely helpful. As Captain Famous said, it brings all the pieces together, but it also allows for the actual analysis of each one of those separate pieces. So the training analysis, the internal affairs analysis, or at least the internal affairs fact-finding, now falls into the hands of the commander to put all that together. And the commander does not always just follow the recommendations of those that are provided to him. I can tell you from personal experience in reviewing some of these things that there are times where you find that maybe there is a disagreement between does this fall within policy or not in policy, and that's the perfect document to put that into to bring it before the police review board.
So I guess part of it's probably that I'm assuming part of the amount of time it may take for the commander's memo to be prepared. So,
yeah, if I might answer that, the Bureau, we agree that in the past it has taken an inordinate amount of time for commanders to present some findings. And we believe that in the last 5 years, 4 to 5 years, we made a tremendous amount of progress in that. Part of that has to do with being under the purview and scrutiny of the United States Department of Justice. Right now, commanders in an officer-involved shooting review have 3 weeks to create that finding. And, of course, in the past, some of those have taken 3 months or even longer. Chief of Police is holding commanders accountable for meeting those timelines. If there are reasons to toll the time period, officers in the hospital, witnesses in the unavailable, we document those for the file. So that timeliness, sir, is very important and certainly is significant. In years past, we believe that we made a tremendous amount of progress in that regard.
And then my last question is the 48-hour rule. I guess I didn't see it identified right here as an outright recommendation.
I didn't either.
Does the Bureau have a position on the 48-hour rule?
The 48-hour rule, I believe, was part of the 2012 or a prior OIR review.
That's where it
was. And currently, right now, that's a collective bargaining. That's a situation where the City of Portland has been in conversation with the Portland Police Association over the 48-hour rule. And I believe that's where that lies. And I believe.
Yeah, I realize it's in the collective bargaining arena. I guess my question is, should it? I mean, is it really a best practice? I mean, I heard the OIR panel say that we're an outlier. This does not really happen other bureaus in other cities.
As it stands right now, Oregon has transactional immunity. So if we ordered an officer that was actually involved in the shooting, we ordered them to give us that information, we would never be able to do anything else with that officer. So if we found that there was some criminal culpability, all evidence gathered after that would be thrown out. So we don't order officers that are actually involved in the incident to talk to us. So they have their Fifth Amendment rights just like everybody else. So if they don't want to talk to us right then, we can't force them to. Now, we do order all witness officers, all folks that might be involved, we do order them to talk, and we usually get to them that day. So we have a pretty broad understanding of what happened, especially if there are witness officers, where it does hurt us if there's only one person involved and there are no witnesses. But again, that officer still has the same rights as every other citizen, and they don't have to talk to us that night. So that's also is where the mix comes. Yes, we would love to talk to the officer involved as soon as we possibly can, and we have taken some good steps in actually being able to talk to the officer quickly, but again, they still have to get their attorneys, and that has to be scheduled. So we're talking to them within 3 or 4 days with their attorney, but the 48-hour rule is an arbitrary rule, and I'm just not sure where we're going to get with that.
Yeah, I guess the other points that ought to be noted is, I'm not sure if I've got this right statistically, but in the last couple of years, while I've been dealing with the issues of officer-involved shootings with the Bureau, we have obtained a larger number of voluntary statements immediately after incidents from officers than was the case in the past.
Correct.
So it doesn't mean the 48-hour rule is not still a problem or a potential one, but we have been getting voluntary statements much more regularly than in the past.
But I think, with all due respect, I think we're conflating two issues here. The Fifth Amendment privilege that can be asserted can happen within the 24-hour, 40 hours, or beyond.
Right.
So that's different. What I heard the prior panel talk about was best practices in terms of investigation, integrity of the investigation, public confidence, investigative leads. Investigations are like uranium. They have a half-life. So I'm hearing an entirely different set of concerns. I don't think the officer has constitutional rights he or she can invoke within 48 hours or after 48 hours. I think what they're pointing out is that we're more likely to get some useful information about who, what, why, basic details for purpose of investigation. So,
purposes of the administrative investigation, not for the criminal investigation. We can't use that information if we order somebody to talk.
Yeah, Chief, could you say that piece again? Because it's new information to me, and
two different, a criminal investigation, which I feel that we strongly need to do in these things. We need to look at this as it is a criminal investigation. We cannot order the officer that is involved in that incident to talk. If we order him to talk, then everything he says is nothing that the criminal aspect of this investigation can use. Only the administrative side can, but then we're no longer conducting a criminal investigation. We might as well just say that we just have an administrative investigation, and we're never going to look at an officer criminally.
Explain to me the legal piece about why that is so.
It's back to transactional immunity. We can't just say, talk a little bit here, and then let us get a little bit of information, but use it later on down the line criminally. Oregon doesn't have that. Oregon, if you give them immunity on one little thing, they have immunity across the board.
But are you saying to us that in interviewing an officer who may have the most relevant information at the scene, prior to determining there may be probable cause to conduct a criminal inquiry, you can't even ask basic questions that would facilitate the investigation? Because the officer can invoke a Fifth Amendment privilege to answering questions.
We do ask.
And that's what I was going
to
add.
So the question is, back to Commissioner Saltzman's question, why the 48-hour delay?
There isn't.
So at every officer-involved shooting, before the officer is released from the scene, the detectives ask the question if they are willing to give a voluntary statement. It's because of the Fifth Amendment, and they are allowed to not provide that statement. If we then give an administrative order to give a statement, that immunity that is then given is carried over for every statement thereafter. So if there are issues of criminality involved, we will not be able to use that.
But what changes after 48 hours?
Nothing for us. Administratively is what we're talking about here with the 48-hour rule.
I think this is getting probably more complicated than it need be. Can you just tell us what is therefore the purpose of the 48-hour rule?
I think it was something contractually that says that internal affairs cannot ask questions of the officer until 48 hours have passed.
Right.
What is the city's view of the necessity of that provision?
Well, that provision is in the PPA contract. And
right.
The city's,
well, everything in the contract's been negotiated between the parties. So what is the city's view of the value of that clause?
What is the Bureau's view, I guess, is what you're asking? Because
nothing in the contract can be in the, you can't have anything in the contract unless two parties have agreed to it. So what was the, what is the city's view of the value of a 48-hour rule?
I don't know what happened in those negotiations, so I don't know why the city agreed to the 48-hour rule.
Well, the negotiations are held by BHR, and yeah. BHR represents the Bureau's interest, and the chief is not part of that negotiation, and the police bureau, we are personally here not involved in that negotiation and not subject to the terms of those negotiations other than the outcomes.
So we have a 48-hour rule because someone in BHR thought it was important and did not consult with the police bureau?
It's in the current contract.
And based
on the information provided to us, it was not something that BHR was going to take to arbitration. So that's a question to be answered by either BHR or by the city attorney, but I don't really think we can provide that answer.
So let me ask you just a slightly different question. What is the potential value of a 48-hour window prior to investigation? What is from your point of view the potential benefit of that? We've heard the case made for why it's out of step with other jurisdictions and the potential damage it does to an investigation. What's the other side of that that you could share with us?
If I might add, two things. Number one, we'd like to know the identity of those jurisdictions so we can review that policy and see if there's things that that we can learn from those agencies. I don't know what those agencies are, so if we could receive that, that'd be great. What we do, the value of the 48 hours is we are able to collect information. In other words, from the internal affairs side, prior to our interview, we like to collect as much information as we can and try to corroborate as much information as we can. So we'll have a review of evidence. We'll review witness statements, officer witness statements, citizen witness statements, and present a line of questioning we think that is going to provide a thorough interview. It also allows the officer time if they've been hurt. We've had officers shot here recently. So although that's an outlier, it does provide some accommodation for that. But primarily, it's to help with present the best investigative interviews we can.
And from the other side of it, the humanistic side, there are some officers who have been involved in shootings who are fully capable of giving a statement fairly early in the incident. We have had other officers who have been absolutely traumatized to the point where being able to provide useful information at that point would not have netted us any value.
And that I completely understand. So let me ask the question in a different context. In the case of conducting an investigation, what is the impact on the quality of any investigation of delay? Because one of the points is made is that with the passage of time, memories fade or recollection is influenced by media reports or reconstructing or whatever. So what's the practical consequence of a delay in getting useful information and investigation? What kinds of things can happen?
I just want to keep this separate, though, as far as criminal and administrative. So I'm going to let you answer this because you're asking an administrative question.
Dave?
Because we do ask the questions, and they don't say anything to us that night. So I'll let Dave answer that question.
I'm bringing up the other Dave. Sorry, but keep going.
So the question is, what is the value of the 48 hours?
No, what is the value of...
What's the downside of delay generally in conducting an effective investigation?
The downside, in my experience, usually information changes rapidly as we develop... As we continue to, find more evidence, conduct more interviews, some stories change than others. To ask if there's a downside, to ask an officer, hey, what happened? Can you explain to me what happened? I don't know that there's a downside to that. It's how do we get there? On my side of the house, the administrative side of the house, typically there will be a follow-up interview because typically in that short period of time, they may not exactly remember everything that occurred because adrenaline and all these other things that are happening. So,
and on the criminal side, there's a lot of information that's coming in within that first 4 to 6, 7, 8 hours we're out at the scene, and we're trying to process and gather evidence. And in most typical cases, if there is such a thing, we have other witnesses who are able to provide enough information to guide us in the direction to gather the most information possible, so that when we do perform an interview, when we get a voluntary interview with the involved member, we're able to do one that is more thought out, that has more information provided to us, so we know what questions to ask. We know what we're looking for. We know what the evidence from the scene has told us. And now we're looking for information from the officer that will corroborate or not corroborate. I mean, it is a fact-finding time for us. That first 24 hours necessarily in processing a scene and gathering information is extremely valuable. And to jump way ahead of that and start asking questions when the basic picture is not even provided to the investigators yet is putting the cart in front of the horse.
And the process that we have now, if I might, is that in that 24-hour window, right now we do, in the last couple of cases, where we've had a voluntary detective statement and voluntary interview, and in that interview, the IA investigator is present in the room. They don't ask questions. They take notes. Once the voluntary interview given to detectives is completed, the detectives leave the room, and then the IA investigator will order the compelled statement for further policy questions, administrative questions, and follow-up, any kind of training issues, those kinds of things. So what happens is, historically, 4 or 5 years ago, you would have a detective investigation, criminal investigation, which may take three or four months, and then you would have internal affairs wouldn't interview them until maybe 6 months after the fact. And now we have the detective voluntary interview, the IA interview, conducted usually in a very, very short time period. So it has really accelerated our review process, and the quality of our interviews has really gone up. So.
I invited Dave Wobrel to come up in case you needed to throw any further light on the Garrity standard and what is afoot with this investigative window here.
I called down for Garrity. If you want a short lecture on Garrity,
push the button.
Is.
Wouldn't hurt.
If you want a short lecture on what Garrity is and how it affects this, I'm happy to do that. Garrity is the name of a case that announced a rule for the admissibility of evidence in criminal cases. Before Garrity, there was the general proposition that statements compelled from a criminal defendant could not be admitted in evidence against them. It's the first Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. Voluntary statements, of course, are admissible, but compelled are not. Garrity itself involved an administrative investigation, which was paralleled by a criminal investigation. So you had an employer talking to their employee about events that were also of interest to a criminal prosecutor. The employer, by right, compelled a statement from the employee, and that information leaked over into the criminal investigation, allowing the criminal investigators to develop other evidence, which was then offered in as evidence in the criminal case by the prosecutor. So the fruits of the compelled statement were offered, and the court said, as a matter of the Fifth Amendment and criminal procedure, that can't happen. So Garrity requires then, if an employer is going to take a compelled statement from an employee, it needs to be firewalled off, and this is how most jurisdictions deal with it, firewalled off from the criminal investigation. A criminal defendant is entitled to challenge any evidence admitted against them for taint from the administrative investigation. And if they can establish that, in fact, there has been leakage from one to the other, the information that resulted, the evidence that resulted, is not available in the prosecution. So it's a rule of criminal law.
In Oregon?
Yes.
In Oregon?
Oregon, it's a principle that applies all across the country. It flows from the United States Constitution.
David, that was a wonderful short tutorial on that piece. So could you tell us how it relates to the 48-hour rule?
I'm It's not directly related. If you take, it's related in this sense. If you take a compelled statement early, you have to take, you have to be in anticipation of that rare case where there is a viable criminal prosecution out of the same event. You have to be very good. You have to be perfect in sealing the information from the compelled statement off from the criminal investigation. It requires the firewall, and that's an administrative, it's very difficult to do. Agencies that take statements earlier end up, for instance, in Phoenix, we went and looked at them. They house their administrative investigation people in completely separate facilities. They have to isolate them completely.
And is it in your view, more likely that you can set up that firewall if you have 48 hours to set it up? Is that part of the thinking? Is that the logic?
Currently, we're taking these compelled statements.
Right.
And it's in a commerce setting.
Is there any relationship between the firewall that you have to have for reasons that you've explained clearly and the 48-hour delay?
No, except that in the hubbub immediately after the event, it's harder to say you're out at a scene and you've got administrative investigators walking around with criminal investigators and people, rumors flying and all the rest of that. It's a tough setting in which to establish and maintain the firewall. In our setting, so later on, we're having these interviews in a commerce setting. You can, as an institution, you can maintain the firewall more easily, I think. There's less chance of error.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Sure. Other questions for either our city attorney or our police bureau staff? Thank you all. We may have other questions later on, but we'll take public testimony next.
And I just have a question of Commissioner Novick, because the only other slight disagreements in the recommendations is number 10, which is that the city should consider requiring the Bureau of Emergency Communication dispatchers to attend critical incident management training, and the Bureau, Police Bureau's response is the decision to require critical incident management training for BOAC employees ultimately lies with the commissioner who oversees BOAC and its director.
And yes, Lisa Turley says that BOAC does do what they call low-frequency, high-impact event training for BOAC people. And she doesn't recall a recent conversation with the police about whether that is insufficient, but she's happy to work with the auditor or with the police bureau to see if they think that additional training in addition to what BOAC already does is appropriate.
And you as the commissioner in charge would also be?
Yes.
Just checking.
Okay, I understand that we may not have our OIR resource people here indefinitely this afternoon. So if there are other council questions for our consultants, this would be a good time to ask them. They'll stick around as long as they can.
Yeah, I don't have any further.
Any further questions for the OIR folks?
Well, just that there was reference to what other cities are doing with respect to the 48 hours. Could you make that information available to us and to the Bureau? What other cities? Because you did reference that. You don't have to do that now, but I guess.
And it was not actually in this report, but the previous one. But, yeah, that's
okay, maybe the previous report. If you could just provide that to us again, or maybe the auditor's office can provide that.
We've seen other agencies successfully thread this needle where, in L.A. County, for example, the Sheriff's Department gets voluntary statements the night of. They don't wait 48 hours to get the statements. In LAPD, their officers have a tradition of not providing voluntary statements, so they get internal affairs statements that night. So there are large agencies that are successfully able to balance the criminal concerns, the administrative concerns, and the most important concerns, which is getting the information from the officer that night.
Well, but you heard the discussion before, and so and Garrity is a federal rule. So there was some reference to, you know, the chaotic nature of a crime scene and trying to maintain these firewalls. So just could you address that?
Crime scenes can be chaotic, but generally what happens, again, LAPD is a good model. The officer is escorted, chaperoned, kept by himself, and then if he declines to provide a voluntary statement at the station, internal affairs is there. They're walled off from the criminal investigators, and they ask the officer, what happened? And it's pretty routine, and it doesn't impact the DA's ability to assess the criminality of the shooting at all in LA County, and it allows LAPD to learn that night what their officer had to say about the incident.
How do they protect against that information unduly influencing the criminal side and compromising someone's Fifth Amendment rights?
Commissioner Fish, they have two teams. They have the detective team that's looking at the criminality and processing the crime scene, and then they have an internal affairs team that's on the ready in case the officer declines to provide a voluntary statement. That internal affairs team does not have dialogue with the criminal team from that point forward. It can be done.
All right, thank you. Other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, then let's take public testimony. I assume you've got a sign-up sheet.
Yes, we have 20 people signed up. Okay. The first three, please, coming up are Mimi German, Teresa Rayford, and Malcolm Chaddick.
Okay, welcome, folks. As you heard, we typically allow 3 minutes for testimony. If you've heard somebody make your point with this many people signed up, then say so, and don't use your whole 3 minutes, but you're welcome to if you need to. We practice decorum in this room, so if you agree with somebody, feel free to give them a thumbs up or a wave, but we want everybody to have a chance to have their say whether we agree with them or not, so we ask that we not have vocal demonstrations in the council in favor or against our fellow citizens. So with that, who's on first? Was Teresa first? Sorry? Were you first? Go ahead, please.
All right. Well, hello, Charlie, and sorry, Amanda, about your loss, and good to see the rest of you guys. And I just want to say that at first, when I went to the meeting last night, I had just found about the meeting in the Rose Room regarding this report. We got to meet with the person who's a civil rights attorney, I think Michael Giannacco, who put it together. And as a community, we were able to engage and ask questions as we looked through it. But we were probably there for about 2 hours. So from the time that we received the information, which was yesterday, to the time that we had with him, that was the extent of the public communication that he mentioned that he had in regards to the information in this report. From your questions and some of the faces that I've seen here, I don't know how much time you guys had extensively with this reporting team or with the police to basically disagree or agree on some of the determinations and the recommended factors. And so with that being said, I think one of the things that they said when they first started was that community involvement needed to be a part of this for this to be a complete report. And that's how I felt that it was brought to me, that the public policy and the benefit to the public would be determined as a factor that would help bridge an opportunity for some of these recommendations to be implemented in our current policy. Without our knowledge, I don't think that we have the value to push you guys to push the Portland Police to adopt these recommendations. He said that just because they have the recommendations does not mean that there has to be implementation of them. And that's because you guys have a memorandum of understanding that basically gives them that type of opportunity. Also, I wanted to say that I know that we have the independent police review that basically hired this team to create this report. Now, without the power of what the police have as far as accountability and measuring the accountability and having oversight and some type of governing force that basically says what was done was right or wrong, then that doesn't give us any value through the independent police review except for a liaison between the city and the police department in regards to bringing in this type of information. So I don't know if they're just a statistic office that brings in investigative information, takes complaints, and then gives them to another governing body that basically has to identify the outcomes of those. But I think that that doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't support our community. I think that as a commission that you guys need to look into creating a civilian oversight that could work independently of the Portland Bureau and of the IPR and in partnership with the city to find out how we can work together to create a safer community through public safety channels for the citizens of Portland.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, Malcolm Chaddick. Thanks for having me up. I don't have prepared remarks for this. It came up rather quickly, so I'm speaking pretty much off the top of my head. The issues covered in this report are on the national stage right now all over the country, and my organization is in the forefront of it in Ferguson. Our executive director is there supporting the people's struggle for justice, And here in Portland, Veterans for Peace will support this struggle as well. The report is an interesting document as far as it goes, but my feeling, based upon my limited exposure at this time, is that the some of the questions that weren't asked were some of the most important ones. The fact that they were evaluating a situation from the point of view of, I don't want to say this wrong, and it may come out wrong. What I'm trying to say, or I'm trying to get towards, is that I didn't feel the root causes of why we're talking about should we be calling an ambulance were being addressed. The fact that in, for example, the Chassis case, we were talking at one point in that conference room about the relative number of, for example, baton blows in another case would be subduing, and then past what point would that be punishment instead of actually, you know, trying to subdue somebody? And my question for them was, well, how many boot heels, how many broken ribs is procedural? Why aren't we talking about that instead of whether or not this man was given proper access to health care on the spot? These are questions I think a lot of people have. And as a member of the community, I hope to help identify and amplify those questions for you so that we can try and make more of a dent in this problem. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. My name is Mimi Gurman, and I want to say that because there's such a lack of citizen input with this report and reports in the past, I feel that is why our police state in Portland is the way that it is. And I'm here today to ask for accountability and real accountability. I quote you, Mayor Hales, from an article this week. The first thing we cannot tolerate is anyone being injured. This is regarding the protests. Public safety for all Portlanders, demonstrators, and bystanders alike is paramount. But you did tolerate injury by our police. You tolerated a concussion bombing thrown into a very, even in that moment, passive moment, nobody was even doing anything, and that got lobbed in there, and people got injured, and you tolerated that. Public safety was denied at that protest. Civil rights were denied at that protest. Mayor Hales, I believe that you are in charge of a regime at this point that is so militarized, and it is called the Portland Police Department. It is oppressive to the citizens in Portland. In the words sent to me recently by Ramona Africa of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia, where I'm from, whose house was blown up by the mayor of Philadelphia in 1986, she says, "We have to take strong stands against injustice, no matter who it's directed at or who is guilty of the injustice. I came today to demand accountability. I came here today to ask Mayor Hales either for your arrest or resignation for crimes of terrorism against the citizens of Portland from the police. You and your police have terrorized an entire community and you've done nothing to curtail the policies that only protect the police and injure the people." Three Wilson sympathizers from Ferguson here for the Ferguson police remain on the force and at our protests. Racial profiling is still condoned by you and by the people who sat here from the Portland Police Department. This cannot be condoned any longer. I ask now for immediate accountability for the police killings, which could and should start with either your arrest or resignation so we can reboot this system in a correct way. The OIR recs are not good enough. We demand accountability, not words like should. This stuff needs to occur. These changes have to happen so that nobody gets killed on the streets anymore. There is no middle ground, Mayor, which you said today. There's only right and wrong when it comes to the police killing people. There is a right way, a wrong way to conduct themselves, and they have shown us the wrong way. We are reclaiming the streets because black men and boys should be able to leave their homes and not be killed for being black. Black is not a crime. Black has become a death warrant in our city, and we will not recede until black is free to walk the streets without fear of arrest or death. We accept civil rights, equal rights, and human rights only in this city. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next three.
Next three are Joe Walsh, Michael Mio and Sylvia Zingerser.
All right, well, if you don't mind, Mr. Walsh, we'll take somebody else first. Sylvia, go ahead.
I'm Sylvia Zingerser, and I'm a NAMI family member, but I'm here as a citizen. Mm-hmm. And a lot of you know that I've been on the CIT and the TAC, right. And I've been watching this happen. I had this written out, but I've changed what I'm going to say, okay? Listening to the OR report, it solidifies that to me that we need to have a quality assurance program, and I know that we're headed that direction. And had we had a quality assurance program in the past, we could have picked up what I call near misses or when these are outliers, shootings are outliers. And I just want to encourage that we continue in that fashion. At some point, Mayor Hales, I would like to sit down and talk with you personally.
Good.
Could we do that?
I think we can do that. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Appreciate you coming. Mr. Mayo, go ahead.
Thank you. I have every intention of speaking directly to you, Mr. Hales, but I'll start off with a little history. 20 years ago, I agree, you were not in elective office at that time.
Oh, actually, I was.
Fine. 20 years ago or so, Mr. Hales, a hostage was taken in our city, and he died from police bullets. The Portland Police Bureau had a hostage situation, and they went in there shooting. And they killed the hostage taker, all right, but they killed a 12-year-old boy. And we asked ourselves, oh, my goodness, how could the police go into a hostage situation shooting? Well, it's because of we've still got the same mentality from the police. Mr. Hales, your employees, the people you supervise, still tell us that their bodily injury is more important than serving the community. You have done nothing positive to forward police accountability since you took office. And the latest objection that I have to your behavior is the universal, all five of you, not universal, what is it? Unanimous, yes. Unanimous decision to object to a federal judge asking to look once a year at what Portland has done for police accountability. In the face of 20 years of procrastination, in the face of granite-like objections from the mayor, I am in my third day of a hunger strike, which takes place in the mayor's office. I will be striking and not eating until we get a positive action from the chief of the person responsible for the police of this city, Mayor Charlie Hales. I will now leave and go back to sitting in his office.
Mr. Walsh.
My name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. One of the things I said to Commissioner Fritz some time ago is that if you think we are a pain in the next wave is really going to be bad. And you're seeing it. You're seeing it in Ferguson. You're seeing it here. And what's the reaction of our police force? The reaction of our police force is to throw bombs at people that are protesting in the streets. There was a city in Tennessee that gave the protesters chocolate, milk, hot chocolate, and water. There was no violence, none. They got along really well together. Did we get along really well together? You could take these reports over and over and over again. All 21 recommendations, they're going to end up on a shelf. We've been doing, this is the third report. And we went to a meeting last night and found out there was no community input. None. This report was finished. So here we are again. We got the report. You're going to accept it. And we are here saying to you, we got a problem, folks. And I'm telling you, If you think I'm a pain in the neck, you watch the young people coming in back of me because I'm getting ready to retire. Good news, folks. However, bad news for you because they're more radical than I am.
Okay, thanks. Okay, next three.
Are Dan Handelman, King Bishop Stilesy, and Mary Eng.
Hey, Dan.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales and Council. I was wondering, since this report is 120 pages long, that gives me 1.5 seconds a page. May I have 5 minutes, Mr. Mayor?
Well, we'll give you a little extra time. Your organization spends a lot of time paying attention to this.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch, and I'm not going to read the prepared remarks that I've handed in. I'm just going to kind of give broad brush stuff and hope maybe you'll have some follow-up questions. Our two major concerns about this report, as much as we support the recommendations and the work that the OIR has done and the transparency this provides, our two major concerns are, number one, that their solution to the problem of poor investigations that aren't as complete as the chief claims they are, or when they're working with the East County Crimes Team, is not to ask for more civilian investigations. We have the Independent Police Review Division. They have just gained a slightly more power to supposedly do independent investigations, though they still have to go through the Bureau to do it. Many people in the community have been asking for years for these shootings and deaths to be investigated by civilians and not by other police. And that should be a recommendation from OIR, and it's not. The other thing is that in their last report, they covered the Keaton Notice case. This time they talked about the issue of Mr. Johnson, the man who had a seatbelt off. What wasn't mentioned is he was in the back seat of the car. And can anybody in this room raise their hand if you've ever been ticketed for having a seatbelt off in the backseat of a car? Anybody? Okay. So my question is, once the car was pulled over, the driver didn't have insurance. It was a Cadillac with no taillights. Was it racial profiling that they tried to ticket the man in the back seat who happened to be a black man who then ran away from them when he realized that they knew he wasn't who he claimed to be? And they ended up dying because they thought he was faking being out of breath. Was it racial profiling? OIR group did not ask that question, even though we asked them to pursue that question after the Keaton Otis case. Another issue that they raised, but they didn't really talk about a way to fix it, is the lack of follow-through afterwards, the lack of discipline, the lack of remedial action, they called it, for anything, you know, redoing training, redoing policy stuff. That can be solved by the person who's been injured or their survivors having the ability to file an appeal with the Citizen Review Committee to the findings of the Police Review Board and the chief, which they can do in every other kind of police misconduct case except for shootings, which makes no sense at all, because then that way the CRC can help identify those issues and the Bureau can deal with them. And I do want to point out that in one of the disagreements, in one of the places where the Bureau said they agreed, actually, was that after a police review board, what the OIR group said is that the Professional Standards Division should go to the officer and say, you were found in policy or you were found out of policy, and then explain all the things that the board talked about, the training, the tactical decisions that were made that were good or bad. So there's a debriefing about the shooting. And the Bureau's response was, we already give them the finding the day of the hearing. But they didn't say anything about the debriefing. So they didn't answer the question. And there's quite a number of examples of that where the Bureau doesn't seem to have understood the recommendations, and I'm going to enumerate them in a longer analysis later. So we're also faced with this problem of how the OIR reports are generated in the first place. Historically, you may remember, when the IPR was first created, there was not going to be any look at shootings or deaths at all. And Jose Mejia was shot in a psychiatric hospital by Portland police, and the community demanded that there be a review of shootings. And what we ended up with is this outside agency coming in every year and looking at the shootings. And as the auditor described to you, it used to take a lot longer, and luckily we're almost caught up. We're at 2011, but it's 2014. These kinds of reviews should be happening as the investigation is happening. We shouldn't be waiting till after everything is closed down. We would get more thorough investigations if somebody was looking over their shoulders appropriately. So on that note, IPR has been going out to the scenes of these shootings and sitting in on the investigation since 2010, yet their name is only mentioned once in this entire report and has nothing to do with the investigation. It has to do with a task force that was set up that they weren't invited to be part of. And I asked OIR if they could include, and they said they would next time, how many times IPR has pushed the Bureau to ask more questions. How effective is it for us to have this independent agency involved in these investigations if the Bureau is not doing thorough investigation of Stell? I also really want to point out that when Mr. Johnson died, one of the things that happened was that he was already in a police car. He had run away from the original site. Other police officers followed the cops to that site, put him in their car, and then in the process of transferring him from one car to the other, there was a huge struggle, which may have led to his death. And I don't understand why, once he was in the police car, why didn't that police car just take him to the hospital or to jail, which they were trying to do? Can I have another minute, Mr.
Go ahead, sure.
Thank you very much. And one of the other issues that you've talked here about here today was the commander's memo. And while I understand why it's an important exercise for the supervisor of the officer involved in the shooting to go through and pull this all to one place, if you eliminate that step, then the community concern that the commander, who has already recommended a finding, gets then to vote on the police review board, and this has a second bite at the apple, we would not be concerned about that anymore, because then the commander will not be having a second bite. So I think you should strongly consider that recommendation to eliminate that step and find another way to do it. And the very long, protracted discussion you had about the 48-hour rule, we really want to see this go away. You know, the community's been talking about this for many years, and we have discussed before, Commissioner Fritz, the issue about Garrity and transactional immunity. And what transactional immunity means is that if you compel the officer to say something, even if you get that information from some other place, you can't use it to prosecute them because you've compelled that from them. So you could, in theory, separate the two investigations, have the administrative investigation only ask questions about their tactics, which has nothing to do with their criminal liability. Or, since we have seen 120 deadly force incidents in our years, 23 years as Portland Cop Watch, and only one indictment in the entire history of the Portland Police for a person who mistakenly loaded live rounds in a beanbag shotgun, maybe we could just not worry so much about the indictment, because it's never happening anyway. So let's just go ahead and compel the testimony on the day of the thing, on the day of the shooting, and we'll find out if the officer is out of policy right away.
Thanks. One thing I just want to affirm, I've been at the scene since I've been mayor for all but one of the officer-involved shootings that have occurred, and the IPR staff was on scene right away. I mean, so in future reports, whoever does them, you're correct, we ought to be finding out what their role was it effective, you know, et cetera. So mm-hmm. I think that, I'm not sure exactly when that change happened. It occurred before I became mayor.
2010.
But, yeah, so it happened at about the end of this particular series of incidents. But now it's the norm. And so we have to see how the norm is working, and that needs to come from IPR as well as from anybody that's looking over our collective shoulder. So I appreciate that suggestion. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm King Bishop Stiles, and new kid on the block, and the thorn in the side that the gentleman was talking about earlier. I represent the Three Kings of Portland, and we'll be addressing matters of importance to the Black collective of the metropolitan area, as well as community of Portland as a whole, in being human beings before we are anything else. I do commend the work being done thus far by the OIR agency, and I do firmly request that the community be heard in writing as a part of the recommendation process. While on the outside it seems that maximum effort is being put forth to deal with the issues of officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths, I have experiences as of this afternoon that there is still a lack of transparency and room to run and hide due to irresponsible actions with law enforcement. Let it be known with great consequence that this issue is not only a local but a national and even worldwide. We are not only here for those in the community who are mentally ill, but all genders, ages, and colors. In the wake of the tragedy in Ferguson with Mike Brown, and even more recently with the non-indictment of the officer who choked Eric Garner to death over a cigarette in New York, we call for you to set the national standard in police being held accountable for use of deadly force. Ending over-policing and criminalization of poverty, have a representative police force and intentional officer training, provide a true right to protest, move to pass national end racial profiling legislation, push for a congressional hearing investigating the criminalization of communities of color, and include community recommendations in the report. Allow sufficient time for community review of the report. Abolish the 48-hour time span that an officer has before being interviewed after lethal force is used. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Ms. Ng, welcome.
Good afternoon, City Council. I wanted to give you a chance.
Just put your name in the record.
Oh, Mary. Yeah. My name is Mary Ng. I would like to give you a chance to collaborate with those members of the United States Congress who put their hands up in solidarity with the Don't Shoot. So feel free, any one of you, unanimous or not, to express hands up, don't shoot, and what it stands for. One thing I heard in the race talks that Copwatch spoke at was the activist who talked about always keeping your hands on the steering wheel. You don't want to be grabbing for a candy bar, a Clif bar, a cell phone, that sort of thing. I want to also thank our officers for their work with the Sunshine Division. I know my next door neighbor's cat is hungrier than usual due to my inability to get over there and get some cat food. And I think in some ways if we encouraged our officers to engage in more humanitarian activities, we could break down some of the racial prejudice and cultural prejudice that is afflicting our community. I wanted to bring up the Kafuri settled Cox case in which the Portland police dragged Cox away from Portland fire paramedics. I tweeted this out to the mayor after you had condemned the monetary damages. And I think the Portland fire whistleblower paramedic who was confident enough in his nursing certification to write up a report of this unusual conduct on the part of the Portland police was lauded in the courtroom and is an unsung hero. I probably have his name written down in my notes, but we should really reach out to him and thank him for seeing someone in need of medical attention when the Portland police wanted to throw him back in the cop car. My mom was a nurse at MCDC. When officers brought in people with gashed heads, you know what she said? Send them to a hospital. But she's concerned that there are nurses who are in breach of their Hippocratic duty in terms of colluding and collaborating with officer misconduct, brutality incidences. And then I also wanted to point out that with the Kendra James killing, when the officers go out to dinner after shooting as they're enjoying this luxurious 48 hours to talk it over, I suggest they go to Veggie Grill, which offers plant-based cuisine, and focus on nonviolence, focus on respect for all forms of life, including animals. In Hong Kong, they arrested officers for beating protesters. And what a shame it would be to say that the Republic of China has more respect for human life than we do here in Portland. We know the DA is too weak to prosecute officers and prefers to punitize National Lawyers Guild observers as well as disabled people. Thank you, Mr. Fish, for your inquiry on the 48 hours. I was impressed by your interrogation tactics. I think you were doing a great job. And don't... Yeah, you know I could talk for hours. If any of you guys ever want to talk to me, my number is 971-222-9558. Bye.
Thank you. Thanks very much, all of you.
The next three are Michael Withy, Crystal, and Melissa.
Okay, come on up. Mr. Withy, go ahead. I think you're first.
Mike Withy. Well, this really comes down to you, Mr. Mayor. You're the one in charge of the police department. You're the police commissioner. We hired you to do the job. Things have not gotten any better for the 2 years you've been in office. You know, we could talk about the shootings. We could talk about stranglings that the police do, but they provoke all sorts of crimes. They provoke crimes in the city of Portland. If they choose to not like you, I have personally witnessed it many times over. They will provoke people they don't like and cause crime to happen in their opinion. So one thing that I've really noticed today is this 48-hour rule. It's obvious, there's obviously a big problem with the 48 rule. I hope that you take serious consideration into changing that, abolishing that. But I do have a question. The question that I have is, who really runs it? Who runs the Portland Police Department? Is it you or is it them? Is it the union that runs the City of Portland Police Department or is it the mayor? I believe that it's the police department that runs the police department. Their union seems to be able to dictate to this council what the rule is going to be, and they get away with it. Why the public has to come here and ask you why there's a 48-hour rule is beyond me. It's something that you guys, especially attorneys that represent the city that are on the council, should have asked this years ago. Anybody knows that the first 24 hours after a crime is when you get all your information. I just heard the chief of detectives say that the best thing that they could do, the reason that he likes the 48-hour rule, is that it gives them time to get information and then come to him with the information they have. Typically, they would ask a criminal, what happened? What's your defense? So things seem to be a little bit backwards. So I can honestly say I moved here from Philadelphia. I moved to the West Coast because it's less dangerous. It's more forgiving. It's a kinder place. But it's really not. The police in Philadelphia are just as dirty and just as cruel as the police in Philadelphia. And it's your job as commissioner of police, irregardless of what the union wants, to do something about what's wrong. And I expect you to do it. I'm not hoping you do it. I expect you to do it.
Thank you. Thanks. Ms. Elinsky, welcome.
My name is Crystal Elinsky. I represent 10,000. Commissioners Novick, Fritz, former Commissioner Hales, Commissioner Saltzman, Commissioner Fish. I am interested in the fact that we are speaking about shootings, deadly force, only shootings, and I don't understand why we live in a culture where we have so many guns. I've never understood it. And even when you come to City Hall to speak peacefully and to help out, there are people present in the room with guns that I do not trust any more than the average person, really, but especially because they happen to be Portland police officers. So I think that we continue to talk about culture, and deadly force is just the next step with heavy-handed tactics. And that's what I see all the time. I mean, I'm a sweet-looking white woman, even though I've had some bad experiences. It hasn't gotten to deadly force, so I can see how it would escalate there. So my own personal experience is that this is sort of ridiculous, that this is how we approach it, with little recommendations, constant pontification, hypothetical pontifications about what we could do when what I see on the ground is very real. Everybody serves the police. This city, the police don't serve the people. The city serves the police. They run with pure impunity, and that's the way it's been. And we need to first talk about that before we can get anywhere else. So changing the culture is one thing, but we were talking about hiring practices. I think it would be swell to start all over again. Why do we continue to hire the people we do? They're all pretty much the same. And I understand there are nice police officers, but when you're in a culture where you can't be a whistleblower, it makes it really hard. Hiring versus training, you know, you really can't train that out of people. When I spoke to every single, there were multiple law enforcement officers on Saturday night, and every single one I told them, I wish you would go through the same treatment that we're going through now. I wish you knew what it felt like. And one of them said, you know, if we did, we couldn't be police officers because it would be on our record. Oh, the irony. I said, you know, many of us would be better police officers than you.
you know, I'm a good shot. I'm pretty good, but I don't believe in guns. So as far as the individual recommendations, we talked about that emergency vehicles, and my experience with EMS is, and others, fire, they do what the cops tell them to do. That's how it is. So it doesn't matter what you